For guys, size matters. But bigger is definitely not better for guys with overdeveloped breasts. The condition is called gynecomastia, and Dr. Frank Lista of the Plastic Surgery Clinic can help. Dr. Lista is a world-renowned plastic surgeon who has perfected the procedure that corrects gynecomastia with virtually no scarring. Visit theplasticsurgeryclinic.ca and size up your options for downsizing male breasts. Theplasticsurgeryclinic.ca.
Jeff Blair is in for Bob McCowan. And you're in for one hell of a show. This is Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Great air guitar songs of all time. It's Primetime Sports. Jeff Blair sitting in for Bob McCowan. Joined now by my man, Arash Madani.
That's a sharp-looking tie you got on today.
Yeah, I don't know whose it is. I just noticed it was on the rack. I don't. It might be Campbell's.
Oh, yeah? It looks like Ken Reed kind of tie.
It's mine.
Oh, is it?
It's mine, yeah. I felt like dressing up.
It's not Primetime Sports Water, so I got to take the label off.
Oh, we must have. We got a new shipment of Primetime Sports Water, I think. Bob Water, as we call it.
Bob Water.
I think we need some Bob Water in here.
How are you?
I'm doing well. So did you hear the one about the Kansas City Royals?
I just did before we came on.
I shouldn't laugh about this.
Well, we shouldn't. I mean, my fifth grade baseball team had some chicken pox issues way back in the day.
Yeah, Oh, God, I can remember. And I got it in grade 12.
Grade 12?
Oh, yeah.
No, ours was fifth grade.
Late. I got it in grade 12.
I blame our catcher, Bill Branscombe, at the time.
When in doubt, blame the catcher. The Kansas City Royals, Andy McCulloch and the Kansas City Star reporting that the Royals have been hit by chicken pox. Alex Rios, who says Alex Rios can't catch anything, right? Alex Rios and Kelvin Herrera have both come down with the chicken pox. They are, at least according to the Kansas City Royals, likely to be out of action for up to 2 weeks. Now, you know, we talked about this in the James Sharman here. We were talking about it in the first hour. You know, ha ha, chicken pox, roll your eyes, laugh, et cetera, et cetera. This kind of reminds us of that NHL mumps outbreak.
Absolutely.
In 2015.
Way back.
2014.
Way back in the day, huh?
Way back in the day. And,
hey, Sonny, come sit on Grandpa's lap. Let me tell you about the mumps outbreak of 2014.
And you know, you look at this. I mean, pro sports teams share facilities. We know that Kansas City was in Tampa on the weekend, and I'm sure, you know, Tampa's clubhouse right now is probably being fumigated or whatever.
Sure.
I mean, it's a serious health issue. Whenever there's anything like this, it can spread around the league very quickly.
And
this is, we're talking September. We're talking pennant races.
This is the money time of year.
So there you go. Something to keep an eye on. And
of all teams, Kansas City, they just go out and get Johnny Gomes. They've been the class of the American League. They're the biggest obstacle to many of the teams, not only in the American League, but all of baseball, and the chicken pox on this first day of September.
Well, and the thing to keep in mind is these guys travel in a charter.
Yep.
They take the team bus to the ballpark. Of course, they're in the same hotel. Most of them are in the clubhouse very early.
Mm-hmm.
So they're spending a lot of time around each other. Humid environments, a lot of times hot environments. I mean, it's a it's got to be a real, frankly, it's got to be a real concern for Major League Baseball, and I'm sure that they.
But of all the infections, the last thing you would think is the chicken pox,
right?
Right.
Well, yeah, because you just kind of, you know.
I mean, I was around a lot of rinks, Jeff, not just in Toronto, but throughout the NHL last fall, and people were literally afraid to shake one another's hands.
Right.
You know, I remember being with Greg Millen. We were in Minnesota doing a midweek game, and I think it was Jason Pominville or something. I shook somebody's hand. Millsy said, you better go get some hand sanitizer going on right now. Like, it was a legit thing and a legit issue. And, yeah, you make an interesting point. If No one wants to go into Tampa right now.
No.
That's home field advantage, all right.
Tampa in August is bad enough. Or else it's September now is bad enough. It is.
I can't believe it's September, by the way.
No, neither can I. Neither can I. It's. I mean, this summer is just zoomed by. The Jays, by the way, will play their second game of the three-game series against the Indians tonight at the Rogers Center. First pitch is at 7 o'clock on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. And Sportsnet East Ontario, West and Pacific, Jays 4-2 losers to the Indians last night, but they're still a game and a half up because the New York Yankees spit out the bit against the Boston Red Sox, and Joe Siddle will join us in a few minutes from the broadcast booth at the Rogers Center. That was quite an August for the Blue Jays on every level. I mean, Edwin Encarnacion's month was absolutely silly. It's the first time since 1950, I think since Ted Williams and Bobby Doerr, that a team had two players with 35 RBIs. That was, of course, Josh Donaldson and Edwin both at 35 RBIs in August. That was really a wonderful month of baseball, wasn't it? And even though, and yesterday, look, full credit to Danny Salazar in the unit. Danny Salazar shut the Jays down yesterday. Full credit to him. That was a remarkable month, though.
I mean, it was an insane month, right? And it was a reinvigorating month for a fan base that has just been begging, clamoring, dreaming of something like this. And having been around the park that first week, you know, right around the deadline, Jeff, and just in the aftermath of Tulowitzki's arrival and then Price's arrival, and the roar last night when Donaldson hit the triple, the two-run triple to put the Blue Jays up 2-1, I mean, that's an October roar on August 31st. It really makes you wonder exactly what this month is going to be like.
Mm-hmm.
When September baseball is relevant, it's wild. And I think now this fan base is now only just getting a taste of what's ahead. It could be a very, very, well, it's going to be an interesting September, but it could be, you know, one of those memorable months that, like Grandpa told his grandson about the mumps of 2014, maybe they'll be telling them about the Blue Jays of 2015, too.
By the way, I did want to point out that just going back to the mumps thing.
Yeah.
The NHL, just trying to find the exact numbers here. At one point, the Minnesota Wild.
Yeah, it was Chuck crazy Fletcher, there.
10% of our team population contracted it.
Yeah.
You know, and the Devils, the Rangers, and Minnesota, the Wild had five players come down with the mumps. So anyhow, just doing some reading in that, just so people know what we're talking about. But bringing it back to the Blue Jays. Yeah, it's obviously the trade deadline that kind of set things in motion for this team. But I can't remember a month in Toronto sports like this that has just galvanized so many people and has just captured so many people. What, you know, even the Leafs run to the playoffs a couple of years ago. It was okay. I mean, the Raptors were cool because the Raptors fan base is cool, right?
And it came out of nowhere.
And, you know, it was one of those things where, well, gosh, in the middle of the year, we're talking about the team possibly trading Kyle Lowry and basically stripping it down, you know, to the bare boards.
This is not compare at all to the Blue to the Maple Leafs Bruins playoff series of a couple of years ago.
No,
that's coming off a lockout.
Right.
That was, you know, you weren't quite sure exactly where things stood, and every Maple Leaf fan was waiting for something to go wrong. And the moment they thought they were in the clear, that happened.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this has been a gradual build, and now it's on a meteoric level. And really, Jeff, what stood out to me of this entire run is not Encarnacion's streak.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the offensive numbers. It's not the shutdown bullpen. It's not Brett Cecil becoming as valuable an arm back there and nobody talking about it. It was that game in Anaheim on a Sunday where they fell behind 5-1 after one. Dickey was pitching.
Mm-hmm.
And they barely blinked.
Yeah.
And the next thing you know, it's 8-5.
And there are times, and it doesn't have to be baseball, Arash. You know this. You've covered a lot of sports. There are times where you watch a game where one team jumps out to an early lead, and you just look at it and you go,
yeah,
it's not over. That was one of those games where you just felt that, I mean, it wasn't in doubt.
Right.
That is...
And that's so unique.
Yeah.
In any sport, to have that, you know, to have that idea.
Well, we'll see what the Jays have on tap for us tonight. It'll be Marco Estrada on the mound. Another deal by Alex Anthopoulos that probably doesn't get talked about as much as it should, but Marco Estrada from day one has been the most consistent pitcher for the Blue Jays.
Absolutely, yes.
And he takes the hill tonight for the Jays against
Jeff, it's
Cody
the most
Anderson.
Underrated move of the Anthopoulos era.
Yeah.
Under the circumstances.
I was trying to think. Yeah, I think you can make that case. You can make that case.
When Marco Estrada was brought here, it was, you know, the thought was, is he even going to be in the rotation
right.
if Marcus Stroman's
yeah,
involved?
I think you can make that case very easily.
Right?
That it was kind of the most under-the-radar move. And it was, what's he going to be? Is he going to be a swingman? Is he going to go in the bullpen? The guy
right.
gives up a lot of home runs. Now, I know that Milwaukee's ballpark is a little, even Miller Park's even a little more homer-friendly than the Rogers Center, but the Rogers Center could still be a launching pad. And, yeah, I mean, there were a lot of questions about that deal. And, gosh, now you can't, I mean, they wouldn't be where they are without Marco Estrada.
Without a doubt.
The trade for David Price would not have happened without Marco Estrada here.
Here's my question. Who's your number three guy in the rotation in the postseason if they get there? If you're John Gibbons.
You know what? It's got to be Estrada.
That's right.
Yeah.
It has to be.
I would go, and well, Joe Siddle will join us. We'll ask him that question. Joe Siddle, our Blue Jays radio analyst, joining us from the Rogers Center. Joe, thanks a lot for doing this. Arash and I were just tossing this around, the importance of Marco Estrada this year to the Blue Jays, and he starts for the Jays tonight against Cody Anderson. Just kind of, for instance, we're looking ahead to the playoffs. Would Estrada be your number three guy?
Well, I think it's going to depend on how guys are pitching, quite frankly. I mean, if we had to look at it today, I think even Mark Burley will admit he's got a bit of a barking shoulder right now, so that could be an issue. So we'll see where we are a month from now, and hopefully they're in a position to make that choice. But obviously with Price being your number one, you can look at the Dickey Burley thing, but I can't believe you can discount Marco Estrada and what he's done. He's been absolutely outstanding, having a career year by many counts, and he's been very durable. Now, he's going to probably hit an innings count here that he's never been to in his major league career. So, again, we'll see where he's at a month from now as well, but I think the health of these guys is probably going to play as big a factor as anything.
He has been their most consistent starting pitcher from day one, has he not?
He's been excellent, you know, and I think the one thing with Marco you look at too, he's kind of like a right-handed Burley. Of course, he doesn't throw in the mid-80s. He'll be around 89, 90 miles an hour, but he's a command guy. He has to be good with his location, and that's where he's been so good. But one thing, if you notice, he's thrown a lot more fastballs. In the last number of starts, he's thrown an increased number of fastballs. He's pitching aggressively, but again, he's locating the baseball. He stays away from the middle of the plate. You hear pitching coaches talk about that all the time. And I think as a starter, when he came out of the bullpen, he's incorporated this little cutter just as a fourth weapon. But with the curveball and the changeup, and his changeup is arguably the best one in baseball. It's outstanding. He pitches with so much confidence with it. He can pitch it, throw it any time in the count. And I think the catchers behind the plate have been an outstanding job. Tonight's going to be Deonno Navarro again, but I found him just very unpredictable, even calling the games from the broadcast booth. You try to think along with them, and you're guessing wrong. So I know that's the same thing that a lot of these big league hitters are doing. Because he has those number of weapons, and he can throw a lot of these pitches at any time, he'll flip that little slow curveball in there once in a while just to keep the hitters off balance. But it's that unpredictability where hitters are not able to sit on certain pitches.
So, Joe, how do you get a scouting report on a pitcher like that?
Well, you look for a pitch that does happen to catch some of the plate, and if he doesn't, it's going to be a long night, and that's what's been happening a lot this year. Ideally, he's a guy that's not going to overpower you, so you may want to look for that changeup. I think that's the best approach for a lot of hitters because, for the most part, you're going to see a changeup or two in a lot of at-bats.
That's sure.
the way he's pitched. Now, in saying that, I've also said he's increased the fastball usage, so that's the adjustment I think that Marco has made and the catchers behind the plate to adjust to the hitters that maybe tried to get on the fastball. It's a big chess game, and you know it's up right now. Marco has been playing that game, but he's been playing it very well, coming out ahead most of the time.
I don't know if you heard Jeff and I were talking about at the top of the clock in Kansas City. They've had an outbreak of the chicken pox, Alex Rios and
Kelvin Herrera.
Kelvin Herrera. They're going to be shut down for a couple of weeks because of it. They're now likely fumigating that Tampa visitors clubhouse. In hockey, they dealt with it with the mumps last year. Do you recall in your playing days, Joe, ever dealing with that or hearing about it going on elsewhere in the game?
Wow, no, that's the first I even heard of this instance in Kansas City. But no, that's very interesting because that's not something where guys are just out for a couple of days. You just said possibly a couple of weeks. That can certainly affect a team like the Royals that are headed to the postseason. But no, I can't recall anything like that throughout my years. I mean, guys get sick and different things happen, but not really outbreaks like that.
Right.
In conversation with Joe Siddall, Toronto Blue Jays radio analyst on Sportsnet 590. The Fan, the Jays, and Cleveland Indians will play the second of their three games tonight at the Rogers Center. First pitch at 7 o'clock. Jerry, Joe, and Michael have the call of the game for you. So the Jays called up Ryan Tepera, Aaron Loop, Dalton Pompey, Munenori Kawasaki, and
just for you, Jeff
Francis. Oh, shut up about Munenori Kawasaki.
It's your boy.
And Jeff Francis. Any surprises in that group? Any surprises in players who have not been called up?
Well, I don't think I'm real surprised at any of the players that have come up. Ryan Tepera was pitching great. He was just a victim of numbers, the numbers game when he got sent down. I think Jeff Francis and Ryan Tepera will probably provide that some length out of the bullpen for John Gibbons, and he said as much today that both of them can give him two or three innings. And I think Munenori Kawasaki just offers you another extra middle infielder. And these guys are probably not going to play a whole lot. Dalton Pompey is probably not going to see a whole lot of starting time unless somebody gets hurt here in the near future. But he's an extra piece, and maybe he can come in, and if he has to play the outfield or steal a base at some point, that's ideal to have. But more than anything, it's the experience he's going to get up here. The one name we didn't hear was Steve Delabar. And
right.
I haven't looked recently as to how he was pitching, but I guess that could surprise you a little bit. But at the same time, you know, you probably don't want – I mean, you want the extra arms, but you don't want too many either because guys just sit here. And that's one thing, it's tricky, you know. And you remember, Jeff, in the Montreal days, I mean, even when you're in a pennant race, you really don't want tons of extra bodies. Mm-hmm. It can almost be a distraction when you've got six and seven guys hitting in a hitting group. And it really takes away from the big boys, too. So you don't want to be doing too much of that either. So at the same time, on one hand, you want to have the extra weapons for certain situations, and they all fit roles. And I think most of the guys do that have been called up here. At the same time, you don't want to bring up too many and make it a distraction.
So could that be the situation with Delabar, Joe?
Well, you know, that's probably a lot more to that. I haven't delved into how he has been pitching exactly in the last little while. So
right.
There may be, whether it's performance-based or anything else, I'm really not sure about that one. I just thought with a guy that was up here earlier in the season that had been doing decently, that I thought that was kind of an obvious choice to come back. Now, I guess the other thing is there could still be a couple call-ups perhaps after the Buffalo season finishes because they do go another week.
You and I was a little surprised Matt Haig didn't get called up. You know, because quite often we see that, right? Guys are rewarded for a good season. In his case, he's the International League MVP. And maybe he comes up after. I don't know. But that surprised me a little bit.
Well, it surprised me a little bit too, Jeff, and I failed to mention his name, but I think he would fall under that category that I just mentioned to you.
Right.
I could see him coming up next week when the season ends and go ahead and leave him in Buffalo to finish the season. More than anything, just as a reward. The guy's had a tremendous season down in AAA. But again, you're in a situation here where a team's in a pennant race and every day is so big and important that, you know, a lot of times when you're out of those things, you reward people and you do all the nice hunky-dory things. But really, right now, you're bringing guys up for roles that you may need now. Matt Haig can fill that role, perhaps, as a bat off the bench, as a right-handed bat. But I think when you're the MVP of the league, you probably have to kind of at least bring them up and reward them for that month of September.
Just want to mention, by the way, that at the FIBA Americas competition in Mexico City, Canada has lost 94-87 to Argentina. That is now a final. Go ahead,
yeah,
Brad.
That'd be the top two teams in that entire event. Joe, the Tulowitzki situation, you know, he gets bumped from the leadoff role over the weekend. It's now been a couple of games. Have you noticed anything different from Tulo now that he's moved down? And have you noticed anything different from Revere batting in the leadoff spot?
No, not a lot. You know, I was a little skeptical at first anyway, but like John Gibbons said, I mean, this whole move really was made for Troy Tulowitzki and to try to get him going. And you'll hear managers talk about that. But you know what, by dropping him down to that fifth spot, maybe he can get back to a more comfortable spot where he's hitting behind those guys, where maybe he'll get some more pitches to hit now. But Ben Revere back in the leadoff spot, it's a comfortable spot for him. I don't see changes in either one of them, and I don't think either one of them will really be different at what they do. I don't think Ben Revere is all of a sudden going to start taking pitches because he's a leadoff hitter. He's just not, that's not the way he's wired. That's not the way he hits. I think for Tulo, it'll probably just put him in more of a comfortable position. I think Troy Tulowitzki is going to get it going here, guys. He's too good a hitter. And when he does, I could see him going right back to that leadoff spot. You look at a situation like that last night. Once Tulo gets hitting, you want him coming up to bat as that first hitter in the lineup in a key situation. Nothing against Ben Revere and what he does. He's a spark plug. He does a lot of things. But bottom line is, there's going to be a lot more thump right there with Tulo's bat. Once he does get going, and I got to believe he's going to.
Well, and I think, you know, Joe, you've been around enough. You see some of the signs, the ability to take a ball, to make good contact to the opposite field, you know, the ability to fight off pitches, to foul off pitches. We've seen that a lot with Troy Tulowitzki lately, and those are kind of things that tell you that a guy's heating up or that a guy may be close to figuring it out. Having said that, though, I got to say that I know the Jays have had some good games pitched at them lately. The New York Yankees, Masahiro Tanaka, Ivan Nova pitched well. The young kid in is it Adam Morgan? I'm forgetting the kid in Philadelphia pitched well against them. But Danny Salazar last night, he got some swings from guys like Donaldson and Batista that we haven't seen since June.
Well, and I think there's a reason why. His stuff was filthy last night, quite frankly. And I was talking about it on the broadcast last night where, you know, you like to talk to players the next day because it's one thing to see it with your eyes at the ballpark or on a monitor, but there's nothing like being in that batter's box. And, you know, to a man, I talked to several today, and most of them, and even Brooke Jacoby, the hitting coach, a lot of the feedback coming back to the dugout after at bats was this guy's ball was moving all over the place. It was almost as though, and I don't want to say effectively wild, but he was inconsistently really good. His slider was sometimes good, sometimes bad. Jose Bautista struck out on a slider his first at bat in the first inning. It was a backup slider. It's not a very good pitch, but any hitter will tell you the best pitch in baseball because it's not doing what the pitcher wants it to do, but it's also not doing what the hitter thinks it's going to do. But for me, the big one was his split change that he throws. And Kevin Pillar just told me about 10 minutes ago we were talking about it. He said some of the times that pitch was actually like taking a left turn. It was like a hard slider, but it wasn't because he said it had that split change rotation. So sometimes it would go straight down. Sometimes it would go down and in a little bit to the righty. And sometimes it took off and went down and away. So he just has a ton of movement on all of his pitches. And then to go with that, he mixed in a little slow curveball. But he's also up around 95 miles per hour with the fastball. And he'll elevate it a little bit, get guys to chase that. So he's just got a lot of very good weapons. And, you know, the numbers don't lie. I think going into the ballgame last night, we knew that this Blue Jays lineup was going to have their hands full. And they certainly did. He's one of the better pitchers in the game.
So when it's that filthy, Joe, is this a prelude to what they could be expecting in October?
Well, sure it could. I mean, really, that's what playoff baseball is, right, when you're facing top pitchers. And that's why the Blue Jays are going to have to counter that. And that's where David Price comes in handy, of course, too. But, yeah, it's tough. If they're going to be facing some tough right-handers, those are going to be tough ball games. But that's usually what happens in the playoffs. They'll have to find a way to try to figure those guys out. Usually the way to do it is to try to get to those types of pitchers early in the count because the deeper you get, he has more weapons. You get closer to two strikes, you become a little more defensive as a hitter.
We had a conversation in Baseball Central with Ryan Goins this afternoon, and we were talking about his, you know, the adjustment he's made at the plate, and he had a quietly effective August, as you well know, Joe. I think he was sixth in baseball in on-base percentage, and he certainly was a contributor to a lot of the good things that happened to the Blue Jays offensively and defensively, it goes without saying. But Kevin Barker brought up an interesting point, and I hadn't really thought of it, about how this has really strengthened John Gibbons' hand now because Ryan Goins is at least giving you a battling at bat against left-handed pitchers. He's, you know, it's not a sure hit when he faces left-handed pitchers, but he's battling them, and it's kind of strengthened John's hands late in the game, hasn't it? Because you're not going to play defense for Ryan Goins ever. So if Ryan Goins can just kind of keep it together, give a good quality at bat against left-handed pitchers, maybe run into the odd pitch or, you know, draw a walk. This really strengthens John's hands in the later innings, doesn't it? And it's something that I think hasn't been stressed enough.
Well, it sure has. And I think what happens is when Ryan Goins starts performing the way he has against both righties and lefties, all of a sudden now we're not seeing that platoon at second base because we were for a short period there. Mm-hmm. We saw Cliff Pennington getting the start against the left-handed pitchers. But then Ryan was having some good at-bats against the left-handers, and it was nice to see that John Gibbons rewarded him for that by putting him in there. So he's put him in there against left-handers. And you're right, you're probably not going to hit 300 against left-handers. He's not going to do that against right-handers. But if you can give a good at-bat, work a walk once in a while, which we're seeing Ryan do, those are just really good plate appearances. And he's even gotten a couple hits off the lefties. Think of the left-handed batter, the one thing you want to do is even simplify things more than you've talked about what Ryan has done making adjustments this year, is you really just have to stay short and think left center, because that keeps you on the baseball a little bit longer. And we've seen him go that way a couple of times against left-handers. And that's really what it is, not trying to do too much. It's just keeping that front side close. That's what left-handers mostly do. Their biggest problem is pulling off. And the other thing is, you don't see them as often. So for a guy like Ryan Goins, it's a difficult task. But he's really, really seemed to be making an adjustment. But I think really what we're seeing out of him this year more than anything is that discipline and knowledge of the strike zone. He's doing a very good job at laying off some pitches and not expanding that strike zone where we saw him chasing a little bit more last year.
Joe, a week ago, the sky was falling on the healthy hamstring, the leg of Russell Martin, and now it seems that it's taken a bit of a back seat in the story department. Have you gotten any kind of sense from Russell if he's limited at all, if it's improved, if there's anything that's bothering him these days?
No, I think he feels pretty good. Now, I wouldn't say he's 100%. He probably won't say that until the season's over and he goes home. That's just the nature of the beast. But I think he's better. I think those three scheduled off days that the Blue Jays had on that road trip really helped. And I think the spot starts and Josh Tolley catching R.A. Dickey, that helped. And by the way, Josh Tolley is going to be here tomorrow, John Gibbons said. So there's going to be another day. So all of those little days, and it can look like a lot of time off for a guy that you're paying an awful lot of money to be your number one catcher. But at the same time, the reason you're paying him that money to be the number one catcher is so that he can produce, and that's going to be when he's healthy. So it's going to be a delicate balance here, I think, throughout the month of September. But I think the way John Gibbons is going about it right now is perfect, because Deonna Navarro is doing a very nice job. And if Foley can take that R.A. Dickey every 5 days, that helps. And then I'm sure in that second part of September, we'll get Russell probably in that lineup a little bit more as he does get closer to 100%. As he warms up and rides, hopefully, into the month of October.
It's amazing how it works, isn't it? Because in spring training, so much of the conversation was, will they or will they not trade Deonna Navarro? Can they get something for their backup catcher? He wanted to catch every day. He wanted to play every day. And now Navarro's become such an integral part of this roster.
Well, there was, and Joe, I'll let you answer this, because I think you may have been there when we were talking to Alex one day, and Alex Anthopoulos, his point of view was, I'm not certain that there's any team that he is more valuable to than us, than that Deonna Navarro is more valuable to than the Blue Jays. I think it's absolutely accurate, don't you?
Yeah, well, I think if you were to look at last offseason, you know, let's go back to, say, last November, Deonna Navarro coming off a very nice season. I think that's probably when he had his most value. But then this offseason continued on. We got down to spring training, the time you're talking about right there, and now things are kind of getting settled. Well, we said all spring, maybe a team is going to have a starting catcher go down throughout the month of March, and then he could slot in somewhere and they could arrange a trade. But that just never really materialized. And then as time wore on, it became exactly what we're saying. Well, now there's probably not a whole lot of value, because now he's here as a backup in the big leagues to Russell Martin. He had his injury there earlier in the season. Navarro did. He was off. So by the time he came back, I think really his value had probably gone down. You're not going to get a whole lot for him. And as it turns out, yeah, he's turning into a very valuable backup catcher. Now, you're probably not going to get the offensive numbers from Navarro as you did last year, but that's just simply a result of not playing a whole lot. It's very difficult what he's doing right now. But no, very valuable, and we see what he's doing. He's going to do it again tonight in terms of catching Estrada. He's done a nice job behind the plate. I'll tell you what, his game calling for me has done a 180, because I'll be the first one to raise my hand and say that I criticized a lot of what Deonna Navarro did behind the plate last year, but he's been outstanding, absolutely outstanding. And then his footwork and his throwing the baseball, he's been great at throwing runners out. So you're right on. He has been an absolute asset to have as a backup catcher, especially in times like this.
I remember you saying last year in the air you'd like to tape a couple of his fingers together so he'd call fastballs more often. Just drop the number one instead of fiddling around with two or three. Mr. Siddle, I'm going to let you run.
All right, Jeffrey, take care, Russ.
See you, Joe.
Joe Siddle, Jays radio analyst and Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
You know, every time I hear his voice, I can't help but think of Luke Wilson sitting across the way beside us.
Yes.
Seahawks tight end who grew up in Windsor. And as a kid, his father, friends with Joe, and they went down to Detroit for a game, and Luke didn't get a Joe Siddle autograph, cried the whole way home. And this year for Christmas, Luke Wilson got a gift in the mail, and he opened it. It was
a Joe Siddle autograph. That is awesome. That is awesome.
So every time I see Joe or hear his voice, that's the first thing that pops into my head.
You have done a very important thing, the most important thing a primetime co-host can do. You provided me with a segue. Luke Wilson, NFL. Nice. LeVar Arrington from the NFL Network will join us when primetime continues on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now more of the best sports talk on the planet on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Catch, eh? Pretty impressive.
Hey, Chris Carter, how we doing over there? All he does is catch touchdowns.
You detected that momentary panic in my face as the water bottle came flying in. It's Primetime Sports, Jeff Blair and Arash Madani for Tuesday, September 1st.
A water bottle with a cap on.
Yeah, it was, and it was also empty.
Empty, so, yeah, and just sheer panic on your face.
Well, I mean, computers, microphones, anyhow. It's all good.
Because you care about the health of the microphone.
I do indeed, because this sucker fell off and broke my computer screen one day.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe, Doug Smith of the Toronto Star will join us later on. Canada beaten by Argentina in the first game at the FIBA Americas competition. But before we do that, we want to talk a little NFL. Specifically, the gift that seems to keep on giving. The Washington Redskins, LeVar Arrington of NFL Network joins us on Primetime. This is like a never-ending story, LeVar. The Washington Redskins.
It goes back way too painfully far for me.
That's why we had you on. I mean, you're the perfect guy.
I mean, it's not like I'm oblivious to why you guys have me on.
LeVar, forget RG3 for a minute. You walk into that building. You're coming out of Penn State. You're ready to play pro ball. At what point along the way did you kind of look around and say, man, this place is screwed up?
When you're in it and you're really deep in it,
yeah.
Sometimes it's very difficult to see. I realized, we didn't win, you know, but you always internally as a player, you always felt as though the next year was it, like we'll pull it together or we'll improve or what have you. I mean, there was always coaching changes. There's always different staff changes. I still always kept a very positive outlook on the team. I think when it had to change for me when, I did my restructuring to help the team and did a new deal to help the team. And granted, it helped me too. But it really, you know, it went south really quickly, and I just felt as though it just made no sense why they would go to the lengths that they did to really try to discredit me and just make it seem as though, you know, I didn't have a brain cell working in my brain. And it was sad. It was unfortunate because I was very loyal to the team, to the organization.
Sure.
I'm still very loyal, still super loyal to the fan base. I mean, I God bless them. I think the world of them. It's such an awesome fan base that they see how bad it is, but they still continue to try to hang in there. To answer your question, it was probably, you know, right when they messed up my contract and put it all on me and made it into a public ordeal. You know, I didn't even want it to be a public situation. I just wanted us to get it fixed, whatever it was. If you weren't going to give me the money, that's fine. If you're going to put the money in there, that's fine too. Either way, I just didn't want it to become public knowledge, and it got leaked out. And who do you think it got leaked out by? You
right.
know? And so it was just one of those things where I watched how many players they did horribly wrong while I was there as a player. And you watch guys like Champ Bailey who didn't want to be there anymore and chose to leave and not redo his contract. It's sad, and it always seems as though you're piling on the franchise for their faults and, you know, their shortcomings. But it's just been so long. It's been a long time. They've been a mess for a long time, and it doesn't look like it's going to get any better this year.
And that's the amazing part. I mean, you're in a city where the basketball team at one point, players were bringing guns to the arena.
Yeah, I was there.
Right? You have a baseball team that was on the verge of doing some damage in October, and they shut down Strasburg. Forget the fact that you have the White House and Congress and Senate. You know, it's the capital city of dysfunction, and yet the epicenter of it is Redskins Park.
Isn't that crazy?
Isn't it though?
I mean, I wish every year that the Hall of Fame inductees go in and I watch it, you know, I sit there and I think about, you know, I gave my best years to dysfunction, you know, and it's kind of, it just kind of bothers me a little bit, you know, every time this time of year, it just kind of bothers me a little bit because it's like if you had the structure in place to have success, you know, my track record kind of speaks for itself. Guys that have come in there, Robert Griffin III, guys, period, that have been there, their track records speak for themselves. How does a guy go from being special on every single, every yeah. level,
yeah.
and then they come to the Redskins, and then it's gone. The magic is like, it's gone. I can't explain it. It's almost a weird phenomenon, and I hate that I'm a statistic of that weird phenomenon.
In conversation with LeVar Arrington of the NFL Network, where ultimately do you think RG3 can go to have success? Is there a place out there that just to you yeah, just sure. screams?
A different profession, probably.
Okay.
You know, for me, I look at it like this. Once you've damaged somebody the way he's damaged right now, I just think that it'll be a long shot for him to turn out to be what it was that people expected and anticipated him to be. You know, when he was drafted, his rookie year, they ran a lot of wildcat, and that read option did very well. And if you notice, it's not just Robert Griffin III that's struggling. It's guys like Kaepernick as well.
There's sure.
The guys that ran that wildcat style offense are now struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And when you break down Robert's film, it's just very simple to see the things that are really, really not good and the things that, you know, make you wonder how, you know, for me, how is he being coached?
Mm-hmm.
And here's the thing. You had to have done enough homework before you drafted the guy. Now, I know they got McVay and they brought in Gruden to fix him, so they have a different group of guys. But I go back and I say, okay, well, you bring him in, and then you draft Kirk Cousins in the same draft. That's the handwriting's on the wall right there.
Sure.
Then you have a great year with him, which, I mean, I think everybody was hoping that he would. He did. He delivered. But the one thing that you could still see in that rookie year that he had a ton of success was his inability to see downfield, his inability to be able to move defenders off of their marks and get to another, you know, receiver, or develop the whole field or see if they're going to pass rush him or, you know, audible out of it or at least call timeout or throw the ball away. You know, you saw all of those things that, you know, you because they were winning and really, in theory, you know, they really weren't winning all like that his rookie year as well. They went on that tear.
Sure.
I mean, they went on a tear to win the division. And it really was never a consistency that was ever developed. And I, you know, I look at it just as much as it is the, you know, the player here. I think it's as much as on the coaching staff.
Mm.
It's just really stuff that you think about. If a guy went number two in the draft, you would certainly think that they would be able to teach him some of the things that he's coming up short in over and over again.
Well, what LeVar is also referring to in that rookie season, the Redskins were 3-6. Mike Shanahan admitted they were in evaluation
yeah.
mode. And the next thing you know, they run off and win the division at a time where that read option was indefensible. And then you give LeVar, professional football coaches, an entire offseason to sit in their windowless rooms, their windowless offices, their labs.
Yeah.
They're going to find a solution to it.
You know, when it's a gimmick, it doesn't last.
Right.
Mm.
And a lot of people try to make the Wildcat into its own offense, like, oh, it is an offense. I remember me and Marshall Faulk had like an intense debate about it, and Dante Culpepper. It's indefensible. Like you said, you can't do it because it does that. That's why I said, listen here, guy. I understand from an offensive perspective how you guys are looking at it, but here's what I'm going to say as a defensive mind, as a person that is going to say, okay, if you're going to make us pay by running this read option by isolating our defensive end or our singular, our strong side linebacker, hit the quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
Period. Point
yep.
blank. If they gash us with the running back, I'll take that. I'll go into the head coach's office or whatever it is. I'll take that. You knock the hell out of the quarterback. And you'll stop that real quick because now the read is really a read from that quarterback. You know, he's not just reading as, okay, he's there, let me hand it off. Okay, let me pitch it, let me hold on to it and run it. If I got that guy that you're isolating running you straight smack over with bad intentions, then how many times are you really going to run that play?
Mm.
And I think it became very evident that defenses were really preparing to hit the quarterback. And, you know, if you're going to try to get the numbers game on us, then you'll get the run, but your quarterback might not make it out of the half. Quarterback might not make it out of the game. And it changed it. And now you can't run it. So I guess it turned out to be a gimmick.
You know, and LeVar, I can remember people saying at the time when people were talking about how successful this is, hey, you know, this is great, but, like, don't go building your entire franchise around the idea that you're going to run this offense for the next 4 or 5 years because, as Arash said and as you said, I mean, defensive coaches are going to figure it out. And I think some teams kind of – they put all their chips in on it, didn't they? And they can't get out of it now.
And you know, there's been two running quarterbacks of note that have won the Super Bowl. It's obviously Steve Young, and then as of recent times, Russell Wilson. But the one thing people have to understand about those two quarterbacks is that they were run to throw, and not run to run. There was no other option, and you ran, and that's what Steve Young and Russell Wilson does now so well. Whereas you look at guys like, and we're talking about Kaepernick and talking about obviously Robert Griffin III, they were not running to throw the ball. They were running.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have a guy that's looking to run and he's only running, a defender knows that. A defender makes book on that. So when you went away from an offense that really allowed for you to be able to be a run-first quarterback, it's now turning out to be the Achilles heel, because you got to be able to throw from the pocket. And if you don't have a pocket and his offensive line doesn't do a great job sometimes of holding the pocket for him, but you got to be a pocket passing quarterback to be able to win. You can run, but you still got to be able to throw from the pocket.
Hey, LeVar, one of the stories we've been following this year in training camps has been the number of injuries to players. And yeah. I know that you're also the founder and the chairman of Extreme Procision. And it's a body. You use body mapping techniques in part to train amateur athletes on maneuvers used by professional football players. Is this Extreme Procision? Is it something that might help mitigate against injuries in the preseason?
Yeah, well, it certainly would help in the preseason to avoid injuries. I mean, it's a proactive approach, and I appreciate you guys bringing up. I would love to be able to do it all over Canada too, as well, because it's something that once you, I always make the comparison to Floyd Mayweather or whoever your favorite boxer is. But Floyd Mayweather boxed and did the same movement for years from the time he started at 16, 17 years old. Until today, he does the same exact movement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you build your repertoire of how to move and how to do things and how to react, and you adjust it to your opponent. It's the same thing that exists in football. If you take a proactive approach to teaching these kids where their eyes should go, where their hands should go, how to use their hands, how to make contact, knowing that you make contact with your sternum, not your head, not your neck. Don't mm-hmm. expose those things, you know, when you're making contact. So it's a proactive approach to trying to, as you said, mitigate some of the major injuries that are taking place. And it's working. It's not just trying. It's actually working. We work with a high school that their concussion level went down almost 100%. The two concussions that they had on the team were guys that actually fell and hit their heads on the ground. So we've done a lot of field testing. It definitely works. And when you play sports, it's a visual game. When you do things that are in athletics, it's visual. So that's all we did, was take a simple concept and turn it into technology, where, you know, we're giving guys from ages 5 and up. You know, I teach a guy in the league. I've taught Pro Bowl football players, and I train them the same way I train a 6-year-old.
Mm.
You know, it sounds crazy, but it's that simple, and it's a lot of repetition.
It sounds Sounds like something you may want to check out. The website's www.extremeprecision.com. This is Primetime. Bob Ryan, Doug Smith next.